All right, welcome back everyone for another deep dive. This time we're going down to Kentucky. Buckle up, because it's about to get interesting.
You could say that again?
Yeah. We're looking at a case called Sturgill v. Taylor. So, you know, just your everyday property line dispute, right?
Yeah, and just a little fence line feud. Happens all the time.
Except this one, well, it's not just about who gets to mow that extra strip of grass. This one went all the way up to the Kentucky Court of Appeals. And it's a real lesson in evidence and how a seemingly small procedural misstep can completely flip the script on you.
And cost you a chunk of land.
Exactly. Yeah. So for all you aspiring lawyers out there, especially those of you thinking about litigation or, you know, maybe even dabbling in property law, this case is definitely worth a closer look. You know, so to set the stage for you a little bit, we're talking about a dispute over, get this, an 86-foot strip of land.
A whole lot of feet.
Right, a whole lot of feet. And it's right next to Highway 119 in Pike County, Kentucky. So, prime real estate, right?
Could be, yeah.
Now, this all stems from a property that was originally conveyed way back in 1935 to a fellow named John Taylor. The Sturgill side, the plaintiffs in this case, they're claiming that this 86-foot strip was never actually part of that original deal, never part of the Taylor property. The Taylor successors, well, naturally, they say, hey, that 86 feet has always been ours. And, you know, they've got their reasons for believing that.
Right, right. But the thing is, and this is where things get a little messy, that 1935 deed, the one that's at the heart of all of this, well, it's got this boundary description that starts at what it calls an unverified James A. Tracy line.
An unverified line, huh? I can already see where this is going.
Yeah, not exactly the most precise legal language, is it?
No, not at all.
Right.
You know, when you're talking about property boundaries, you really want things to be crystal clear. You want those lines to be solid, not, you know, not unverified.
Exactly. And that lack of clarity is exactly what opened the door for this dispute to even exist all these years later.
So essentially what the Sturgill folks are trying to prove is that if you could actually figure out where this James A. Tracy line really is, it would show that the 86-foot strip falls outside the Taylor property. So to try and bolster their argument, they bring in some witnesses. And one of the key pieces of evidence they present is testimony about an oral agreement that was supposedly made between the original seller and John Taylor himself. Now, this is where things get a little tricky because, well, John Taylor, he's no longer with us.
I see. So we're talking about the dead man's statute.
Bingo.
Mm-hmm.
The dead man's statute. Now, I know that sounds a little ominous, but basically it's a rule that's supposed to make sure things are fair in court, especially when one of the people involved in a conversation or agreement, well, they're not around to give their side of the story.
Yeah, makes sense. You can't exactly cross-examine someone who's passed on.
Exactly. So this statute, it tries to limit what a surviving party can say about those kinds of conversations, particularly if what they're saying could affect the deceased person's estate. It's all about preventing, you know, someone from potentially twisting the facts in their favor when the other person involved can't speak up to challenge their version of events.
Yeah, that makes sense. So in this case, the defense, they try to use the dead man's statute to keep this testimony about the agreement with John Taylor out of the court record.
Yeah, you know, perfectly reasonable move, right? They want to protect their client's interests. And, you know, this testimony, well, it could be pretty damaging if it's allowed. But here's where things take a turn, and this is what I meant about a procedural misstep potentially backfiring. Even though the defense objected to this testimony, you know, said it shouldn't be allowed, they then proceeded to cross-examine the plaintiff's witness, get this, about the very same agreement.
Oopsie daisy.
That's
not the best move strategically.
Yeah. You can't really have it both ways, can you? It's like, you know, you're standing in court and you yell out, "Objection, Your Honor," and then you turn around and start peppering the witness with questions about the exact same thing you just objected to. It's like, you know, what are you trying to do here?
Yeah, it sends a mixed message.
Exactly. And the appellate court, they picked up on that. They saw that cross-examination as, you know, kind of waiving that initial objection. Like you're saying, okay, well, we do actually want this information to be considered after all.
Yeah.
And just like that, that testimony about the agreement, it becomes fair game.
Yeah.
Admissible. It's a classic example of, you know, the legal equivalent of shooting yourself in the foot.
Yeah, and that kind of procedural slip-up, it can have a ripple effect, can it? Suddenly, what seemed like a minor issue, it becomes a pretty big deal in the overall scheme of the case.
Oh, absolutely. You know, that's why trial strategy is so important, you know? Yeah. You've got to be thinking several steps ahead, anticipating all the possible angles.
It's a chess game, isn't it?
It is.
And the stakes are high.
Absolutely.
All right, so now we've got this testimony about the agreement. Huh. And it's in play because of, you know, this whole waiver situation. But the Sturgill folks, they've got another trick up their sleeve. They present a lease agreement as evidence.
Yeah.
And this one's pretty interesting. It turns out that just a year after John Taylor bought this property back in 1935, he actually leased some land. And get this, the land he leased was located east of his property. And who did he lease it from? The same person who had sold him the original tract.
Now, that is interesting. Why would you lease land east of your property if you already own a disputed strip to the west of it?
Right. It's a good question, isn't it? Makes you wonder if John Taylor himself even believed he owned that 86-foot strip. You know, it's like, if he thought it was his, why would he need to lease that adjacent land?
Exactly. It's like, you know, you wouldn't rent a car if you already had one in the garage, would you?
Nope. Not unless maybe you had a really good reason.
Right. So this lease agreement, it kind of throws a wrench into the Taylor successor's argument, doesn't it?
It does. It really does. Now, could there have been some legitimate reason why John Taylor leased that land, even if he thought the strip was his? Maybe. But it certainly doesn't help their case.
No, it doesn't. It definitely raises some eyebrows. You know, like, okay, well, if you thought you owned that land all along, why'd you go and lease this other piece right next to it? It definitely adds another layer of complexity to this whole thing.
It does. And speaking of complexity, you know, this wouldn't be a proper property dispute without some conflicting surveyor testimony, would it?
Of course not. Got to have the experts disagreeing.
Oh, yeah. So the plaintiffs, they have their surveyor who comes in and, you know, draws up a map, does their calculations, and supports the Sturgill side's claimed boundary line.
Makes sense.
And then naturally, the defendants, they bring in their own surveyor who says, nope, that's not right at all. If you go with the plaintiff's boundary, it's actually going to overlap with this nearby subdivision.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, just your typical he said, she said situation.
And this kind of conflicting expert testimony, it's pretty common in these sorts of property disputes, isn't it? Because you're dealing with, you know, old deeds, sometimes they're handwritten faded ink, you know, measurements that might have been taken with, you know, who knows what kind of equipment back in the day.
Yeah. And then, you know, you've got the land itself, which, you know, it can change over time, right?
Mm.
Erosion, new construction, trees growing, you know, who knows what else.
Yeah.
So it's not always a simple matter of just, you know, drawing a straight line on a map and saying, okay, that's it.
Nope, not at all.
So here we are. We've got the plaintiffs. They've presented their evidence. They've got this testimony about the agreement that's now admissible, thanks to the waiver situation. They've got the lease agreement that raises some serious questions. They've got their surveyor backing them up. And then, boom, the trial court dismisses the case.
Just like that.
Just like that.
Huh.
Yeah. And this is where we need to talk about bench trials. Because the way a judge handles a case without a jury, it's a little bit different.
Right. So when you've got a bench trial and a defendant asks for the case to be dismissed after the plaintiff has presented their evidence, the judge in this situation, they're not just deciding if there's any evidence at all, you know, like a tiny shred that could support the plaintiff's claims. They can actually weigh the evidence that's been presented.
So it's like they're not just a referee. They're actually a player in the game.
Yeah, exactly. They're the referee and the scorekeeper. They get to decide if they think the evidence is believable, if it's strong enough to even continue with the case.
Interesting. So in a jury trial, the bar for dismissal is set pretty high, right? The judge has to basically look at what's been presented and say, okay, there's just no way a reasonable jury could side with the plaintiff based on this.
Right, right.
But in a bench trial, the judge, well, they've got more leeway.
Exactly. They can consider not only whether there is any evidence, but also its quality and persuasive power. They can make a judgment call early on about the credibility of witnesses and the strength of the evidence presented.
Okay. So more power to the judge in a bench trial. But in this case, Sturgill v. Taylor, the appellate court, well, they weren't too happy with how the trial court handled things.
What happened?
Well, the appellate court, they said the trial court messed up. Big time. They basically said that even though a judge in a bench trial can weigh the evidence, they still have to give the defendant a chance to present their side before making a final decision.
So even though the judge can weigh the evidence, it's not like they can just cut the trial short and say, well, I've heard enough. I'm ruling for the defendant.
Nope. Not in this case anyway.
Yeah.
The appellate court was pretty clear about that. They basically said that the trial judge should have let the Taylor successors present their defense, you know, let them tell their story, show their evidence before deciding anything.
Makes sense. Everyone deserves their day in court, right?
Exactly. It's all about fairness.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the Mellon Court, they reversed the trial court's decision and sent the whole case back for a new trial.
A do-over.
A do-over.
Yeah.
You got it. So, yeah, Sturgill v. Taylor, it's a reminder that even in these seemingly straightforward property disputes, things can get complicated fast.
Oh, yeah.
And the rules of evidence and procedure, those are not just, you know, boring technicalities that you learn in law school and forget about. They can make or break your case.
Absolutely. They're the foundation of the whole legal system, aren't they?
They are. So for all you future lawyers out there, listen up. Pay attention to those procedural rules.
Yeah. Don't underestimate the power of an objection or the consequences of, you know, maybe not objecting when you should. And for goodness sake, don't cross-examine a witness on the same thing you just tried to get excluded from evidence.
Word. That's some free advice right there, folks.
Take it and run with it. And, you know, this case also highlights the importance of clear and precise language when it comes to legal documents. You know, if that original deed had a more definitive description of the boundary line, well, maybe this whole dispute wouldn't have happened in the first place.
True that. And for anyone who might end up practicing property law, remember, precision is key. Vague language can lead to years of litigation, and, well, nobody wants that.
Yeah, nobody wants that.
So there you have it. Sturgill v. Taylor, a seemingly simple property line squabble that turned into a pretty big legal lesson, and a reminder that the rules matter. Procedural missteps can have huge consequences. And always, always be careful what you ask on class examination. You never know what kind of can of worms you might open up.
Well said. It's a wild ride in the world of law, isn't it?
It is. And we'll be back next time with another deep dive into the legal world.
Can't wait.
See you then.
See ya.